Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. People were overjoyed when it rained last week in the Bay Area, and then it stopped. So will we get enough rain this winter? That's what we're all asking. And will it be cold enough for it to snow in Tahoe? What effect will that have on California's ongoing drought? Unfortunately, according to the NOAA Climate Prediction Center's outlook, El Niño is not expected to make a significant difference. The state's severe drought continues to persist now in its fourth year, and it's affecting everything from dry vegetation to the loss of ecosystems. Dubbed Ground Zero of the drought, Tulare County in the Central Valley has experienced severe water shortages. Thousands of residents are still living without running water. A recent NASA study found that 15% of irrigated farmland in the state went idle for the past year because of the drought, and tree mortality continues to increase. The Forest Service has identified more than 12 million dead trees in California. The drought will cost the state's economy more than $2.7 billion and could result in nearly 21,000 job losses. That's according to a UC Davis study. So are state officials doing enough to address the far-reaching effects of the drought? Joining us to talk about these issues are three guests. Juliet Christian-Smith is a climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. It's based in Oakland. Juliet is the lead author of the book, A 21st Century U.S. Water Policy, and is editor of the journal Sustainability Science. And Juliet joins me in studio. Hi, thanks for coming in. Nice
thanks
to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Ryan Jensen, a community organizer for the Community Water Center. It's an environmental justice organization that works for community-driven water solutions in the San Joaquin Valley. They work with low-income and farm worker communities. And Ryan joins us from Visalia. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you. Anthony Ambrose is a tree biologist in the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley. Anthony has been studying the ecology and physiology of coast redwood and giant sequoia trees for more than 18 years. And he joins us from the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism radio studio. Hi, Anthony. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Good morning.
Good morning. So we did a number of series on the drought. We haven't talked about it in just a couple months. And just doing the research, it seems really dire, especially this news from the NOAA Climate Prediction Center's outlook saying that El Niño is not expected to make a significant difference. Juliet, let me start off with you. Things are pretty dire right now.
Yes, this is definitely the most severe drought we've had on record, if you define drought as demand outstripping supply. So we've had other periods where we haven't had a lot of rain in the 70s, but we've never had such warm temperatures, such low snowpack, and so many people demanding water.
Because right now, snowpack levels, which fill reservoirs that provide drinking water for a third of the state, are at a 500-year low. And we're all wondering, is it going to get cold enough in order for it to snow in Tahoe?
Right. Well, we're starting to see, and we have been actually for a couple decades, the consequences of global warming. And one of those is the warming temperatures. Last year, for the first time, the average minimum temperatures in the Sierra Nevada were actually above freezing. So that is not good for snow. And as you know, our whole water supply system in California is really based on the snow providing a really lovely storage technique for us where it holds it where it falls in the winter, and then it slowly releases it into reservoirs and lakes so that we can use it in the summer, the spring and the summer, when we need it the most. If we don't have that snow, or if it's melting a lot faster, or if we're getting rain, the system doesn't work as well. And that means that these traditional supplies, snowmelt-fed rivers, lakes, reservoirs, are not going to be working for us in the future. And we have to rethink our whole water supply system.
And what are your thoughts, Anthony? Do you feel like there is a sense of urgency? I mean, is there where you are?
Absolutely. You know, the Forest Service and more recently the Carnegie Airborne Observatory have been surveying levels of tree mortality and water stress throughout the state. And, you know, there's millions of trees that have already died and probably many millions more that are going to die. You know, combination of drought stress and insect attacks, beetles on the pines, for example, is really having a major effect on the forest ecosystems throughout the state.
And so explain, we'll talk more about this throughout the show, but why are so many trees dying?
Well, it's basically, you know, the combination of drought stress and the insect attacks on many of the trees and forests throughout the state. You know, the increasing temperatures and the lack of adequate snowpack have really created a deficit in the soil water that's available to the trees and forests. Combine that with a historical legacy of fire suppression, which has increased the density of the trees in many parts of the state. So there's a lot of trees that are competing for a limited amount of soil moisture. They're getting weakened by that drought stress, and that's making them more susceptible and vulnerable to insect attacks.
When we had the rain last week, it was so nice to see the trees wet for once. But what are your thoughts, Anthony, on this NOAA Climate Prediction Center's outlook that El Niño is not expected to make a significant difference? Will it make a difference for trees?
Well, every little bit helps, obviously. So, you know, we'll take what we can get. But the deficit, I think, is so severe that it'll take more than just one good winter. And particularly, you know, El Niño is traditionally been associated with a slightly warmer temperatures. So we may get a lot of precipitation in the state, but maybe not as much snow as we would hope for.
Right, because it's hard to know. Even if it pours, we don't know what the temperatures will be like. So we don't know if it'll be cold enough for it to snow.
Yeah, you know, this last storm, actually, there was some pretty good snow up the higher elevations. You know, if you look at, like, Yosemite webcam around Half Dome, for example, there was some pretty nice snow, but it's melting pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we don't get some major storms, and particularly later through the season, that really build up the snowpack, you know, the snow can maybe come and stay there for a little bit, but then melt. So, you know, we really need a sustained long period of snow accumulation to really solve the problem.
It's nice to hear that about Yosemite because, Juliet, I was there a few weekends ago, and when you stand in the valley, you can usually see 10 to 15 trickling waterfalls. This time there were none. And then at Mirror Lake, it was bone dry, which I've never seen before. And the forest rangers were actually shocked at how little water there is in Yosemite.
Yeah, I think people are, we've been saying for a while, climate scientists have been projecting longer periods of more severe drought. A NASA study came out a few months ago that says that there's an 80% chance that we'll have a mega drought in the Southwest sometime this century, and that's a more than 20-year long drought. And this is what that looks like. We're starting to see it on the ground, and of course it's shocking because it isn't something that's in our historical memory. And actually, people, millennials, have experienced a totally different climate than other generations. We really are starting to see some massive consequences of the greenhouse gas emissions that we've been putting in the atmosphere.
And Ryan, you're a community organizer for the Community Water Center. It's an environmental justice organization that works for community-driven water solutions in the San Joaquin Valley. And what is concerning you right now? Because I mentioned that UC Davis study. It also found that an estimated 17,000 seasonal and part-time jobs were lost last year, and we'll probably see even more jobs lost this year. And you work with low-income and farm worker communities. How are they being affected by this?
Well, the low-income communities and small unincorporated communities here in the Central Valley that we work with have been impacted in a variety of ways. As you mentioned, they're not getting the income or the hours of work that they were accustomed to getting. But a big part of what we've been seeing is that Community Water Center has been working on sustainable drinking water issues since 2007, and it's been a chronic institutional problem in the state for many years. But many of the vulnerable communities that haven't been able to access safe or affordable drinking water for many, many years are the same communities that are now being disproportionately impacted by this drought. Just to kind of tie everything in, the previous two guests were speaking about how the snowpack provides most of the surface water for our uses in the Central Valley. And what we've been seeing is over the course of this drought, and especially this last summer, as irrigators have gotten reduced allocations or in many cases zero allocations of surface water, they're turning increasingly to groundwater as their primary source of irrigation water, which is drawing down water tables. And what we're seeing is that a lot of these communities or people on private wells, as these water tables drop, it's leaving their communities or their private wells dry, and they don't have the financial resources to be able to replace those water sources. So we've seen, for example, the community of East Porterville is kind of like the ground zero, even here within Tulare County, where over 500 homes are essentially left with zero source of water because they were all on private wells.
Wow.
And in many cases, those homes have gone more than a year, in some cases almost 2 years now, with no water in their home at all.
2 years without water. On past shows, we have interviewed people who live in East Porterville, and at that time, they said that they were relying on donations and bottled water. And now I'm reading articles about these companies that are trucking in water to various communities. It's like a booming business in the Central Valley. So how are these families coping without running water?
Well, we've seen a lot of different responses to the drought with people who don't have water. We've seen a lot of neighbors helping neighbors. If one neighbor has a functioning well and their neighbor's well has gone dry, they'll run a garden hose, you know, literally over the fence to their neighbor to keep them with just the bare necessities to be able to, you know, meet basic sanitation needs, flushing a toilet, bathing. But in many cases, that may not be drinkable water, so they also are turning to donated bottled water to meet their cooking and drinking water needs. And as you can imagine, in a lot of other cases, people are turning to water filling stations or, in some cases, you know, basically people are getting water anywhere that they can get it. So we see a lot of farm worker families who will work, you know, an 8-hour day out in the fields, a 10-hour day out in the fields. And then at the end of their day, they'll turn around, come home, and get 50-gallon drums and go back to their work site or bring them with them to work and fill them up with the well water from their work site, which, you know, this is generally going to be, you know, an additional several hours of hard labor at the end of the day just to fill and transport these water sources for basic needs. And in many cases, they're not entirely sure if that replacement water that they're getting is safe to drink.
And we should say that we're talking about areas with some of the highest poverty rates in the country. According to reports, we're talking about a median household income of about $14,000. And because some people cannot find farm work in that area, I've also read that families are being split up because maybe a husband has to go to Washington State to find seasonal work, but even that's not guaranteed.
Yeah, that's correct. It's people who have been depending on the farm worker income have been, you know, found their income cut. They've found that there's more competition for less hours of work. You know, even the farmers that are irrigating, if they're bringing in a decreased harvest, then there's less need for manpower to care for and then harvest that product. So we are seeing a lot of families broken up, and we're seeing entire communities split up where, you know, people just have to, out of desperation, they have to leave the home where they've lived and built their life for many years and move elsewhere where they can make a go of it.
Ryan, and during past shows, a lot of activists have said that they feel like the state is not listening to them, that they don't have a voice at the table or a seat at the table. I mean, now that this is getting national headlines, I mean, if you have to look for it, but it is getting attention, have state officials done anything about this?
Well, I can say that the state response has actually, there is some urgency at the state level. Governor Brown passed a bill for $1.9 billion in drought relief. And that's specifically for water replacement water supplies or improved water infrastructure projects. That includes $19 million specifically for emergency water supplies. But a big part of what we've been seeing, and we held a convening of drought response practitioners back in August where we brought together multiple county officials, state officials, and local community-based organizations and nonprofits all to talk about the drought response and what's going on. And I think a bigger bigger issue than I think there's a lot of money that the state is putting towards the drought response, but the bigger problem is that there's not really a mechanism to deal with a prolonged emergency like this. So some of that money is going through Office of Emergency Services, which then goes down through the counties, but they're not equipped to deal with a long-standing emergency like this. They're more built to deal with an immediate acute disaster response, which gets cleared up in the short term, and then things go back more or less to normal. And a lot of these people responding to the drought don't have experience dealing with water infrastructure projects or with the traditional funding agencies or regulatory agencies that manage those projects. So I think the bigger issue that we have identified isn't so much that there isn't an urgency in Sacramento, it's that there's a lack of coordination of getting the resources that the state is providing from Sacramento to the people on the ground where it's most needed. So I would say that's a bigger issue. And the money that has been put forward is, you know, it is a significant amount of money. They're probably the need is greater than the amount of money that's being put forward. But I think the bigger issue is the coordination among all the people that are working on the ground to make sure that those resources are getting where they're needed most.
That is Ryan Jensen. He's a community organizer for the Community Water Center. They work with low-income and farm worker communities in the San Joaquin Valley. We're also joined by Anthony Ambrose, a tree biologist in the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley. He's been studying the ecology and physiology of coast redwood and giant sequoia trees for more than 18 years. And tree mortality is increasing in the western U.S. The Forest Service identified more than 12 million trees on California land, and a lot of these trees are dying. We've been seeing this over the past couple of years. Juliet Christian-Smith is a climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, lead author of the book, A 21st Century U.S. Water Policy. Today, we are talking about the drought. So many people were excited when it rained last week. Unfortunately, it didn't last for very long. And also, the NOAA Climate Prediction Center's outlook, I know I keep repeating this, but it's really important. It says El Nino is not expected to make a significant difference. We definitely need the rain. We also need it to be cold enough for it to snow. So what questions do you have about the drought? How is your community being affected? And have you received many conservation messages? Do you think they're effective? Do you think that state officials are really talking about this with a sense of urgency? Do they really know how to deal with this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you work on these issues, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Juliet, what do you think? Do state officials know? I mean, when you look at how the drought is affecting wildlife or trees or poor communities, the AP just had a piece about salmon. Another deadly summer of drought has heightened fears of extinction in the wild for California salmon, according to federal officials. I mean, there are just so many things that are being affected by the drought.
Yes. I think it's probably overwhelming for state officials, to be honest. And just getting back to what we were hearing about what's going on the ground in Tulare County, you know, what we've typically done in the state is hope that next year is going to be wet. As that is no longer a sound policy solution, one wonders if it ever was, but, you know, as that no longer works hydrologically, we're going to have to develop a different way of managing these water systems that we've come to rely on. And that systemic change is not yet happening. We're kind of dealing with this with a bunch of Band-Aids, dealing with the symptoms, not the overall problem. And I would say that we haven't yet got our heads around the fact that we're really going to have to shift from the surface water dominated system to much more of a focus on groundwater. That being said, the state has taken some important steps last year, passing the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. And that was the first law to require statewide groundwater monitoring, measurement, and the beginnings of a regulation system. So for the first time, we're going to start understanding what's going on with our groundwater resources, which have been really what saves us during droughts. But it's a supply that we've overtaxed and overdrafted.
And what are your thoughts, Anthony? Peter Glick of the Pacific Institute recently wrote, quote, the recent severe droughts in the western United States and California in particular has shined a spotlight on a range of water management practices that are outdated, unsustainable, or inappropriate for a modern 21st century water system. He writes, unless these bad practices are fixed, no amount of rain will be enough to set things right. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think he's absolutely correct. We do need to face the reality that we're entering into a new era, and we can't rely on the systems that we've had in the past to carry us forward into the future.
So what currently would you add to that list? What is wrong with our management system, and what would you change?
Well, my specialty is trees and forests in the state, and you know we have unfortunately more than 100 years legacy of poor management of much of the forest lands throughout the state in terms of fire suppression and mismanagement of forests that has created a situation that they're more vulnerable to drought stress and wildfire. You know, and as we move into a warmer future, we're going to be faced with a situation that's I'm sure is overwhelming to forest managers, where we have millions of acres that need to be treated, thinned, understory thinned, or fire reintroduced into these systems where it was historically much more frequent. We're kind of caught behind the eight ball on this situation. I'm not exactly sure what can be done other than increase maybe the level of funding and efforts to try and be preemptive in treating some of these landscapes before they either die or burn up in the future.
I would just add on to that. Completely agree with everything the professor said. We've also made some important strides in California in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions reductions goals. So as most of your listeners probably know, we just passed SB 350, which extends our commitment to having more renewable energy in our electricity mix here in California. That was a very important goal. Win in terms of what's causing all of this. The drivers behind the warming is these greenhouse gas emissions. And we have an important meeting coming up in Paris where we're hoping that countries will make real commitments to reducing their emissions because, that could make a huge difference in terms of the amount of change that we're going to have to deal with and that our state officials and our local resource managers have to deal with.
Right. And we're going to do a week-long series when the Paris talks happen. Last week, we did a show about the Keep It in the Ground campaign in California. The Solutions Project at Stanford has an amazing plan for all 50 states to be 100% clean and renewable by the year 2050. And just yesterday, Senator Bernie Sanders introduced a Keep It in the Ground bill at the federal level. So this is getting a lot of traction. Does that make you...
Hopeful. I mean, you have to stay hopeful at some level because we do have choices here. We have choices about what we're going to leave to our children, and we can make better choices or worse choices. And I have a lot of hope based on some of the changes in governments that we're going to see more leadership from North America and that we're going to see more leadership from other countries are stepping up to the plate. And we really need to make sure that we do that in the near future, because then we start to lose the ability to make the better choices.
Right, like tomorrow. Today we are talking about the drought and how it is affecting the state. We're in year four. We got some rain last week. We're hoping that it continues to rain, and we're also hoping that it is cold enough for it to snow in the Sierras. We'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about the drought? How is it affecting your community? And if you work on these issues, we would love to hear from you. It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Please let us know if you're a first-time caller. We'd love to hear from new voices on the program. And if you would prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback at yourcallradio.org. Feedback at yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 from the World Service of the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. And then at noon today, Bina.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be talking about coverage of super PACs and money in state elections. How did money affect the elections this week? We'll also talk about a Center for Public Integrity investigation about the Koch brothers pouring more than $19 million into higher education to forward their political goals and build a pipeline of libertarian-minded students. We will also talk about President Obama's plan to send special operations forces into Syria. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are getting an update on the drought, and we are hoping for rain. We need the rain, but the NOAA Climate Prediction Center's outlook says we have to be realistic. El Nino is not expected to make a significant difference. So we're talking about where we are right now and where we are going and what needs to be changed, how are state officials dealing with all of this. Today we're joined by Juliet Christian Smith, a climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Ryan Jensen is a community organizer for the Community Water Center. They work with low-income and farm worker communities in the San Joaquin Valley, where a lot of people do not have running water. Anthony Ambrose is a tree biologist in the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley, and you can join us at 866-798-8255. Do you feel where you live that you're getting messages from state officials about the urgency of what we're facing? Are you getting conservation messages? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I was wondering what the guests thought the impact would be is going to be on Governor Brown's tunnel project going under the Delta, diverting water from the north to the Central Valley, and what that impact will be, particularly in the middle of a drought. Why are we doing that?
All right. Juliet, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I cannot provide a prediction about what will happen with the Delta Tunnel plan. It's gone through so many different iterations. But I will say that the drought has created more of an interest in water storage systems. And last year, we passed Proposition 1, which was a water bond, and it included some money, $2.7 billion, for additional infrastructure. And right now, there's a big conversation going on about what does that infrastructure look like? Should we be putting that money into more of the traditional surface water storage projects that we've done in the past, or do we really need to be thinking about maximizing our ability to use groundwater to recharge our savings account when we have rain and snow, but rain particularly, which we're expecting to see more of, and so that we can draw it out in drier periods. So that's a conversation that's going on at the state scale. And the Delta tunnels are a piece of that. How does that kind of surface water infrastructure, how does it tie into more groundwater banks and more groundwater recharge areas throughout the state? There are a lot of questions that are being asked, and we really need to start to see the system as connected. None of it can be taken apart any longer. We really need to make sure that our surface water storage systems are recharging groundwater and that everything's working together.
Well, we are going to vote on this next year because there's going to be a ballot measure that would require voter approval for large public works projects, including the plan to dig giant tunnels to divert water from Northern California to the south. The measure was initiated by a Stockton area farmer who opposes the project. And under the initiative, this is according to the LA Times, the state would have to seek voters' permission before funding projects that cost more than $2 billion with revenue bonds. So this is going to go to the voters next year.
Right. And, of course, that that proposition is, I think, specifically aimed at the Delta tunnels, but it would affect any kind of infrastructure project. And there are actually a lot of hurdles already with Proposition 13. We have a Proposition 218. They all limit the kinds of funding that can be raised and require a lot of support going to voters. And so it's actually very difficult to raise funds right now, and this would make it even harder.
And Anthony, do you have anything to add on this one?
I'm not familiar with the situation with the tunnels, so I can't really speak to that.
Okay, Ryan, did you want to jump in?
So I was just going to comment that I agree with everything that's been said previously. I think that a big part of the issue that we're dealing with is as was previously said, that our attitude towards water infrastructure projects and the way we use water needs to change substantially. I think a big part of the problem that we're seeing here in the valley and why groundwater is being so severely overdrafted is that we have spent, you know, basically California's water infrastructure is built on highly subsidized supplies of water, that surface water that get moved from the north to the south. So farmers have gotten used to having cheap water and abundant water, and you know they've built farming systems that are dependent on that water, having access to that water year after year. So when that water is not available, what they have to do is they turn to the groundwater. And a big part of the issue is that, you know, despite the fact that we're in an epic drought, Fresno, both Tulare County and Fresno County had amongst their best years in history of agricultural production. So what we're seeing is that when it comes to agricultural water use, it's essentially been business as usual. They've just drilled more wells and accessed more groundwater to replace that surface water. And just to give you an example, here in Tulare County, there's been just under 2,000 reported well failures, but the county of Tulare has approved over 4,000 new well permits in the same amount of time.
Wow.
So for every one well that's failed, there's been two new wells drilled to continue accessing that groundwater. And I do want to talk a little bit about that Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, because that is a sea change in how California is going to manage their groundwater. But it's going to take, you know, until 2017 until the local agencies are established to manage that groundwater, and then until 2020 until a plan is in place to actually achieve sustainability. So in the meantime, the only authorities that have any, the only people who have any authority to limit groundwater extraction are the counties through well ordinances. And I will say that some three counties in particular, Stanislaus, San Luis Obispo, and Merced, have all three approved either emergency or permanent ordinances that limit the extraction of groundwater until the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act comes to full sustainability. But in the meantime, what we're seeing is that it's essentially been business as usual, and people are, especially when it comes to agriculture, which uses 80% of the water that is used for human use in the state of California, it's essentially been business as usual, just replacing that surface water supply with groundwater.
According to Reveal, they've done some great reporting on this. Since the drought began, farmers are pumping enough water annually to supply every single home in the state of Texas. Some of this water is 20,000 years old. It's unsustainable and causing the state to sink at historic rates. Juliet, I've been reading about some of the state's biggest water wasters. We're talking about people in homes, like using 1,000 gallons of water a day. And they're starting to name names. I'm just going to bring up this piece in a minute. But why aren't we doing the same thing for farmers? And do you think we should be? Because do we have that information? Do we know who's actually pumping the most water?
No, that's one of the problems. We do not have that information. So that's one of the major victories of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, is that it is finally requiring that information be collected. It won't be individualized. It'll be aggregated data, but you know, you can probably figure some of it out. And also, the governor's budget also opened well logs, which are the it's the paperwork that well drillers have to fill out when they actually drill a well. It gives a lot of information about the geology, really important stuff for the state to know, and it tells how deep the wells are, where they are. All of that is becoming public right now. It's being digitized and hopefully will be available electronically soon for people to be able to answer some of these questions.
The East Bay Municipal Utility District revealed a list of 1,100 households that have been penalized for using more than 1,000 gallons of water a day. George Kirkland of Danville, a former Chevron executive, is using 12,579 gallons of water a day. The Oakland A's executive, VP of baseball operations, Billy Bean, using almost 6,000 gallons of water a day. So they're naming names here.
Right.
Are they going to do the same thing with groundwater users?
No, I don't think so. But there are some things that are kind of public knowledge. We know that we're taking out of the ground 1.2 million acre feet more than we put back in each year in the Central Valley. We know who the largest irrigation districts are, and we know some of the largest growers in those irrigation districts. This is a situation that we don't have the same kind of reporting, but we can come to some conclusions about where the water is being used. And even just looking, you know, if you're driving down I-5, you look around, you can see where we're growing rice in, you know, the southern Central Valley. So you can see how water is being used in different places. And that has to do with our very complex water rights in this state, where we have recognized all sorts of different rights. We have more different kinds of rights in California than anywhere else. We have old English rights. We have Western right, appropriative rights. We have Pueblo rights. We have all sorts of different things happening. And what that boils down to is we've promised the same water to a lot of different people, and that system is crumbling during this drought. And I think the State Water Resources Control Board has kind of made that clear by trying to stop. They can issue notices of curtailment saying, stop taking this water. It's no longer available for your use, and it hasn't worked.
Juliet Christian Smith is a climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Ryan Jensen is a community organizer for the Community Water Center. They work with low-income and farm worker communities in San Joaquin Valley. Many have been living without water for 2 years. Anthony Ambrose is a tree biologist in the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley. And Anthony, I feel like so the trees don't really get their due in conversations about the drought just because things are so bad. I mean, when you're talking about human beings who don't have running water, when you're talking about the ground sinking. But the tree issue is also really, really important. And I mean, how do you bring the death of trees into this conversation about the drought and why that is so important?
Well, I think it's really important for everybody to realize that, everything is connected in our system, and the trees and forests in the state are important in terms of regulating the hydrology of these watersheds and providing clean water to downstream users. And so we really need to take the whole ecosystem into consideration when we're talking about these issues. The plants and animals that provide so many services and wonderful opportunities for recreation and the biodiversity that is supported by these forests is critical to our well-being, and we really need to take those things into consideration when we think about these larger issues.
Right. And there was a piece at Time Magazine about how wildlife is really struggling, and Jason Hawley, supervising wildlife biologist with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, said animals have to adapt. Those animals that cannot adapt are not going to survive.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of animals up in the Sierras that are suffering as a result of the current drought. And, there's a lot of bears that, for example, in Sequoia National Park that are really looking scrawny. And there's been more bear encounters down in the foothills where they're searching for food in people's houses and such. These cascading effects. And, another important thing is the economic factor of the forests, and the role that forests play in the state is tremendous in terms of the timber economy and other forest products that are a huge resource to the state and provide tremendous services. And there's going to be severe economic impacts from, you know, if millions of trees continue to die, there's going to be cascading effects through the economy.
And what can be done to try to prevent this? Anything?
Well, you know, one really important tool is prescribed fire. That is a really effective management tool to thin out some of the understory trees and plants that are competing for water with each other. Some careful and selective low-impact understory thinning can be a really important tool in national forests and private timberlands. There's a danger of unforeseen or unintended consequences from logging, so it needs to be done in the correct manner. You know, you can't be going in and logging the biggest, oldest trees in a stand because those aren't the ones that are at most risk of fire, for example.
Anthony Ambrose is a tree biologist in the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley. He studies the ecology and physiology of coast redwood and giant sequoia trees. Juliet Christian-Smith is a climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Ryan Jensen is a community organizer with the Community Water Center. They work with low-income and farm worker communities in the San Joaquin Valley, where many families have been living without running water for 2 years. They have no choice but to rely on bottled water, and many are relying on water delivery companies. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks. I hope I can bring up a number of issues here. One is I live in Palo Alto, and I go to a park up in the foothills, and I noticed that there are trees dying in that park. And I talked to some of the rangers, and they didn't have a very good explanation. I'm feeling that we use too much water up in this park. Anyway, that's one issue. The other thing is that I wanted to find out, because it was brought up just briefly, about crops that are grown in the Central Valley. It's my understanding, and these crops take enormous amounts of water, like alfalfa, pistachios, almonds, things like that. So I'm concerned about that. I also wanted to see if your guests have any opinions about desalinization at this point. I know it's an expensive proposition. I don't know if it would work, but for large metropolitan areas like San Francisco, Los Angeles, and maybe San Diego, it might work. I think Israel now has, they rely on desalinization quite a bit. I also hope that the people of the state will find a way to reject Brown's proposal for diverting the water through the tunnels. And lastly, I wonder if they have any opinions about water capture. I mean, people actually trying to save runoff and whether or not, you know, if this was done on a large scale, that this might have some impact, at least with regard to water use.
All right. Lots of questions there. Thanks, Greg. Why don't we get the desal question on every show. Juliet, do you want to take that one?
So I just got back from Australia.
Oh.
And while I was there, I toured some water capture facilities and heard a lot about what they've been doing with desal. And I was actually most impressed by the water capture facilities. So I think I'm going to start there in that a lot of homes and businesses have these very large cisterns underneath in the first floor of their houses or in the basement. And they're catching the water that does fall on their roofs and would just be lost. And they're reusing that within their house or on their gardens. And they're doing this at a much larger scale than we are in California right now. And I think it's kind of been considered a little bit of a fringe issue and something that, you know, certain homeowners who are very green might be interested in. In Australia, it's not a green thing. It's the way that they get through prolonged droughts, because they had a 10-year drought, their millennial drought. So, you know, they've just normalized gray water use, recycled water use, and they have built several desalination plants. They they aren't operating all of them because, of course, it is very expensive water. And what happens sometimes when you build a desal plant is you might get rain, as they did in their case, or when people start seeing the cost of the desalinated water, they can start conserving. So there's a price elasticity, or people respond to higher prices by using less of something. And in some cases, that's meant that we've mothballed desal plants here in the States and also in Australia because there just wasn't the demand for that water. And even if you turn off a desal plant, you still keep paying for it. You still have to pay back the loans for the capital infrastructure, even if it's not turned on and producing water. That being said, in San Diego, they're coming close to completing a new desalination plant there. They decided it was worth it for them. They have very expensive water, and they don't have many other options. So I think it's something we're going to see more and more, and there's going to be more and more debate about the cost effectiveness and what we need to do first. So are we actually conserving water? In Australia, they're close to using around 50 gallons per person per day. There's only a couple cities here in California that are at that level. We're using much more water in many places. So you know, what can we gain by utilizing our existing resources better? I think that's kind of the first step. And then the next step is, okay, how do we find additional supplies? Is it recycled water? Is it capture? Is it desal?
Greg also had a question about food, and we've done a lot of shows about this, but has anything changed? Because, for example, alfalfa has gotten a lot of media attention. National Geographic has a piece on this about how, because dairy, the global dairy industry is exploding, and so alfalfa is being grown in California, then it is sent to China, Japan, and the United Arab Emirates to feed to cows, which a lot of people say makes no sense. So has any of that changed after some of these issues have gotten some attention in the media?
You know, I'm not close enough to the commodity groups, the alfalfa growers, to know how that's affecting them. I do know that if you're growing alfalfa in California, you probably have a pretty secure water right, or you have good access to groundwater. And as long as that's the case, there isn't a real external reason that you would choose to do something different. And so that's something that, you know, we sometimes look at the results of our system and think that doesn't make sense. But in some ways, those people are responding to the signals we're giving them by saying, you know, you have very inexpensive water, you have a very secure water right. So then they make decisions that make sense in those conditions. But as we've noted, the water rights structure itself actually doesn't make sense. It's overpromised water and it underdelivers.
Yeah,
and I can
Ryan,
add a little bit to that, because what we are seeing here in the Central Valley is that when it comes to farmers making decisions about what they're going to grow, a lot of those decisions are being made on an economic calculus, and as was just mentioned, that the water is cheap, so a lot of the time, you know, that the sustainability of the water supply is not part of the calculus when a farmer decides, well, am I going to rip out my grapes and start growing almonds, for example? And something needs to change with the mindset of when we decide to put land to use for some kind of productive purpose. Sustainability needs to be part of that calculus. And increasingly, what we're seeing here in the Central Valley is that a lot of the land has been, you know, purchased up by large landowners and large growers who may not even live here in the Central Valley, so they're entirely divorced from the sustainability of the communities here in the area.
Right.
And they're ripping out older, possibly less water-hungry crops and putting in things like almond trees and pistachios and alfalfa for export to China, which, because that's where they can make the most money. But, you know, one other thing really important to note about when you put in permanent tree crops like pistachios and almonds, you can't fallow those. That's not a field that you can fallow when, you know, if your water supply doesn't come through in a particular year. So when you put in a tree crop like almonds, you're committing to having the same amount of water available year after year for decades on end. And that's just an unsustainable practice.
Well, thank you again for the call. We just have a couple minutes left. Juliet, what are your final thoughts? I mean, we're all wondering what's going to happen in the next couple months. Are we going to get enough rain? And will it be cold enough for it to snow? What are you working on in the next few months?
Well, I think what we're working on at the Union of Concerned Scientists is really trying to talk to the public, talk to state officials and people who are making decisions about having a longer term, more systemic view. So we need, when we're thinking about building new long-lived infrastructure that's going to last 50 or more years, we need for those kinds of decisions to be made, thinking about all the things we talked about here today, all of the interconnected forest, water, human health issues that we know are changing due to climate change and human growth and development in this state. So we really want to make sure that some key decisions that are being made pretty soon are around Proposition 1, how the water bond money is spent, and how the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act is going to be applied. Regulations around both of those two issues are coming out in 2016. So we're focused on those processes and trying to inform them with the best available science.
And we will do shows about them. What about you, Anthony? Final thoughts?
Well, I think it's really important that we realize that we live in a dry climate here, and we're coming out of a relatively wet century, but both natural cycles as well as increasing temperatures associated with global warming are going to be changing that. And we take water for granted, both for the ecosystem as well as our own uses, and it's not properly valued. We've heard a lot of the symptoms of this mindset here, where the economics just don't jive with the reality of the situation of living in a climate that we do here in California. And we really need to rethink everything on both personal as well as institutional and governmental levels of giving proper value to water and conserving it like we really should, and the precious limited resource that it really is, and that it's going to become even more limited probably in the future with increasing populations and changing climatic conditions.
And Ryan, just briefly, what about people who don't have running water?
I think that a big part of what this drought has done has sharpened the focus on a lot of the unsustainable practices around water management here in the state of California. And one of my concerns and one of the things that we're advocating for is to make sure that this increased attention and resources that have been made available to deal with the drought doesn't get squandered just because, one El Nino winter is not going to solve this problem. And even if we do come out of this drought by some miracle next year, there will be another one. So we want to make sure that this focus, this attention, and the resources that are being made available are focused not just on the Band-Aid solutions that we have talked about before, but that they are also being geared towards more long-term, sustainable, permanent solutions.
Ryan Jensen is with the Community Water Center. Juliet Christian Smith is with Union of Concerned Scientists. Anthony Ambrose is a tree biologist in the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley. Thank you all for joining us.
And thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of super PACs and money in state elections. We'll also talk about a Center for Public Integrity investigation about the Koch brothers pouring more than $19 million into higher education to forward their political goals and build a talent pipeline of libertarian-minded students. We'll also talk about President Obama's plan to send special forces into Syria. What grabbed your attention in the news this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.